Okay, we'll go up to Fairbanks. Roger Burngrass, are you there, Roger?
Yes, I am. Mr. Chairman and members of the Resources Committee, the honor is great, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this evening. I'm Roger Burngrass. I reside in Tracy Creek Road, Fairbanks, Alaska. Today I'm testifying as a man.
We begin with the Senate Bill 375 that we deal with open intent of the chairman to move this bill out of committee. Once we have adopted the committee substituted as well as an amendment by the ombudsman, plus another amendment that we'd like to offer to that bill. Next, we will deal with House Bill 135, the City Building Resources Compact. We'll have our first hearing on Senate Bill 391 and go for some public testimony on that bill. Then we'll have our first hearing on House Bill 408 and have some public hearing on that bill. Then on to House Bill 542 and 543, which were in subcommittee, and the chairman of that subcommittee was Representative Ivan. And that those bills will be heard, and hopefully we'll move them out. And I would also like to announce that we will finish at 5 o'clock, hopefully before. And then at 6 p.m. we will meet here again, and we have another four bills to work on. That'll be a long day. We'll get back now to Senate Bill 375, which was heard yesterday. And first, we'd like to call on Mr. Aaron. If you would please.
Go ahead, Tom.
The Senator has reviewed the proposed gap and is agreeable to.
Without objection. So we had before the committee House 2017 what we would like to do is put forward a conceptual amendment which would not allow people who work for the state a single employee in addition to be able to go out and be guides or work in the guiding industry 6 months after they have that time with the state. The reason for that is that I guess the best thing to do is to demonstrate that by analogy and others that legislators are not committed to lobbying or become a lobbyist. Those people would possibly have some information that we or could be used for advantage out in the field. And so that is the reason for this conceptual amendment.
Jay, did you have anything else you could add on that? That is the idea, to put forth a conceptual amendment that would not allow a person who is a seasonal employee working for fishing game to be able to work in the guiding district for up to 6 months after they have left saving time. Are there questions or are there comments with regard to the conceptual amendment? The representative thinks of something.
I'm not too sure the implications of a period full-time employee that they can put it. How about if somebody's already arrived and they just decide to count fish for someone to employ, you know, 6 weeks out of some other areas, it's really hard to get jobs in some other areas. Is that person just qualified for 6 months? So it's continuing the guidance.
The guiding business or the kind of trying to get that person's right to a state job to one and
two? I'm just trying to understand how, whether it's best, I guess you're saying that person, if they take a temporary job in coming to, even for a couple of weeks, they wouldn't be able to return to being a job for 6 months.
Well, the intent of conceptual amendments that we're discussing here is if you count and fish, that's one thing, but if you're in the game guiding business, that's another. So I would be amenable to, you know, restricting it to those who I just don't think it's right for people to work. Well, what we're trying to do here is level of things. You know that people who enforce the law as a state trooper or fishing wildlife enforcement will not now be, if this bill becomes law, will we no longer be able to work within the industry. And I think that would level the playing field for others who have that kind of inside information, if you will. It seems almost fair that the other people are not going to be allowed to do as well. So, as regards to each question, I can see where working as a fish counter at one point that we were before. But even so, even in a fish counter in a remote area, I could argue that they have a pretty good inside scoop on where to bury them. So I don't know if it's something that we can discuss. Let's go ahead, Representative Frank.
So maybe the way to do it is just to amend C2 on page 2 to say, employed by part of this game, authorized by teacher of this game, the first division of AS-16. I don't know the language of the actual conceptual, but we just take the root language and just say, while they're employed as officials after this section 2 seems to be discerning between people who are fish counters and people who are involved in enforcement. They have to not only be employed by part of this game, but they also have to be
Yes, I did have some comments on this issue, and following along the line of representing the pickup side, regarding seasonal employees of the Department of Fish and Game. For example, I guess I, it's kind of a question or a concern, and asking if this is the intent of the bill. Well, it is, but I don't know if this, that's what we fully understood. But let's say you had a person that was working as a seasonal in the fishing area, and then they also were a guide in the game area.
Before you go, let me ask at this point, as a seasonal employee, could that person be deputized as a fish and game enforcement officer?
Yes.
Okay, good, good.
I guess the department would like to have you consider excluding seasonal employees from this prohibition during the period of time that they are on leave without pay from the department. And there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, obviously, their seasonal position, they can't make a full-time living off of that unless you're living off a very minimal lifestyle. And this is one of the ways that is fairly common, I understand, for people to do this kind of work in the department during one part of the year and then do some kind of living employment in another part of the year, especially in rural areas. We would like you to consider excluding seasonal employees from this provision during the period of time when they are on leave without pay from the department, and they're not working for the department, essentially. And I want to make that clear that we're not talking about like the weekend. If a person is on staff and wanted to go out on the weekend during the period that they were getting paid, then we would, agree that that should be prohibited. But we're talking about the time when they were not working for the department, and during the winter months or something like that, and allowing them to pursue this occupation during that time.
How many seasonal employees are we talking about?
Well, I was not able to get, we have approximately 800 seasonal employees in the department. And I was not able to find out how many of those were deputized and would be affected by this legislation between yesterday and today. But there are a large number of people that work for the department.
How many of those 800 employees, seasonal employees, probably do work within the green guide position under our office when they're not working for the state?
Well, I understand there are a few. But I can't give you an exact count.
Does that mean 2,000, 3,000?
I really don't know. I tried to, basically what we'd have to do to find that out is we'd have to contact the regional staff and find out, we'd have to get in contact with the supervisor who knows the life of the people that work in his unit, in the whole unit, and find out, how many people do you have that fit this category.
Well, if we don't know how many people we want to exempt, then how do we know that your concerns are legitimate? And if there are seasonal employees here that are having access to information the same as what enforcement officers have, why should we treat them any differently than the regular enforcement officers? If in fact that very same person could be deputized and for all intents and purposes be an enforcement officer?
Well, they may not have that kind of inside information. For example, say they were working in Tom Fish, and they were taking sales, or they were running a fish wheel, or they were involved in some kind of management activity. That wouldn't necessarily give them inside information on the availability of game, or where game could be found, that kind of thing. Your example of the bears, usually when you have fish, you have bears. The bears usually wait till they get up in the shallow water. I think that's the kind of thing we're concerned about. You'd basically be taking away somebody's opportunity to make a living between balancing these two activities. And I wasn't sure whether that had been considered, whether or not
that. It is a dilemma for this conceptual amendment. But you know, what we want to do is to make sure that if people with inside information as full-time employees do not have the opportunity to go make a living off of the public resource, then what makes that different from the seasonal employees? Just the fact that they're not employed full-time, but to me that is not sufficient. I don't know, are there other concerns by members of the committee? That looks into Simplecast.
Thank you, Chair. I guess the question is, in P2 here, have we already drawn that line carefully enough to leave out the person who counts fish scale or measures fish scale, whatever, so this is the people who are actually enforcing the law. Basically, P2 draws that line. Do you think that's good enough to draw the line that they have to not only be employed by the department, but also authorized by the commissioner to enforce provisions of law?
Now, I'm not sure that it does. Clearly, if a person was not deputized, they wouldn't be covered by this. But if a person was deputized, even though they might be doing something totally unrelated to the guidance, they would be prohibited the way I read this.
So, but I guess you might be right. They might not be related directly to big game guidance, but they are going to be related to enforcement. You were using the example of someone who sits with a microscope looking at fish scale. That person isn't deputized, are they? I'm trying to understand the difference of all the categories.
Well, somebody in field personnel, you know, working on, say, taking scans or working in the field are deputized as well. Not all of them, but frequently they are, because they sort of function as an extra set of eyes and ears out there and augment the thin staff of public safety.
Bruce, did you say, did I hear you say that you asked that this language in P already, in fact, excludes seasonal employees?
No, I don't have a doubt.
But you're saying that you think that we should make an exemption for seasonal employees?
For the period of time that they are on leave without pay from the department.
Yes. What's your opinion, sir?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it is a confusing category. Do most of your people go into layoff status, or do they go into leave status? They stay employees year-round even though they're only employed for 4 months?
Yes, we have a number of permanent part-time employees that go into a layoff status. But they may come back for several years and work at a particular location, say manning a Wanigan monitoring commercial fishery or a subsistence fishery or running a weir someplace or things like that. Then they come back, for several years running.
Mr. Chairman, there's two issues. One that Bruce is raising is all this, you have to have another amendment to this bill to make an exception. That's a different issue than the conceptual amendment before. Conceptual amendment, I think, is the best interpreted is using a period after the end of your employment,
right,
where you'd be excluded from these jobs. And I do, if there are people out there who are deputized who aren't doing this, it does make it a little bit confusing. The category, when you think of somebody who's out there part-time or full-time doing enforcement activities, though, it does seem pretty clear to me they ought not be a guide in part of the season or on the side. Either way, it doesn't make any sense to me. So I wish we had a better way to differentiate between the groups.
To reiterate here, conceptual amendment deals with the time period of time after an individual leaves state employment that they should not be allowed to participate in big game guiding business. The other concern is the seasonal employee, the seasonal exception. Let me ask you, Mr. Bruce, about the seasonal employee. if that person was working for the state, it was during that time then that you suggest that that seasonal employee cannot be also employed on weekends at the beginning of the year.
That's good.
Is that, so your concern is a little different from mine. Is your concern then that we have to add language and see on page 2, the end of section 1, to address your concern?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I was really addressing the amendment that you discussed yesterday rather than what you introduced today. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at this line that you would see.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I told you to prepare for.
So they're dealing with actually two conceptual amendments. One, we want to deal with an amendment that deals with seasonal employees, and we'll deal with that one. Secondly, first I would like to concentrate on just the time issue. I would like to offer an amendment that would be conceptual in nature that would prohibit a person from guiding or being involved in the guiding industry for up to 6 months, at least in that particular unit area where they're working. And it seems to me that that would be fair for all employees across the board, as far as it should not be just, well, of course, the full-time law enforcement officer is going to be out of there anyway. But I think that for sure we want that for seasonal employees. And I would also like that for a full-time enforcement officer after he leaves state employment. Do you understand? There's two elements here, right?
Yes, I think I understand. Just one question on the seasonal, though. Wouldn't the effect of the conceptual amendment be the same as how would you exclude a seasonal employee from the prohibition if they be involved in a guiding activity, and if they're also with the department, if you had this provision that they couldn't do it for a certain period of time afterwards? In other words, it would be like every time they went on to layoff status, you had 6 months, the whole period of time that they would be prohibited by this other provision.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a concern of mine.
Representative Finkelstein?
And I think that the solution is to, both of these, is to redefine who we're covering here. What we're saying in C2, C13, is people who are authorized to be involved in enforcement provisions, authorized to enforce fishing game laws. And what we're hearing is that's too broad a group. So why don't we just change it to say authorized and actively involved, so that it isn't somebody who's out there just trying to fish who happens to get the fish. They have to be someone who is actively involved in enforcement. I think that's the point of this.
One of the problems, I think, that people find is that the seasonal employee may not be actively involved, but he certainly can become actively involved if he is deputized, right? So we're going on.
Correct.
And Mr. Chairman, I think what we're trying to do here, just from what everyone's saying, is prohibit people who are actively involved in enforcement from then going on and being a guide or doing it at the same time. So if we could just redefine it somehow to say those people who are actively involved, then the ones who are involved in enforcement wouldn't be able to, and the ones who are not involved in enforcement wouldn't be able to. The reason we have this problem is just because the language used here.
it says the people who are authorized, which apparently are people who are deputized, which apparently is a very big group. And we can lead up to the department if we say actually involved to figure out who it is. But it's, generally we include people who are enforcement officers. I think that would solve this problem, then we go to the next problem of part time and.
So what is your proposed language in 2 to deal with?
Be on C2, I'll try to leave it some conceptual stuff on how to make this sound perfect, but the particular is actively involved in C2. So it's actually involved and authorized to enforce the position. That's probably not perfect drafting, but.
Good. I think what we should do is we're going to have to not send this out. Conceptual amendment, but we're going to have to get the drafters involved in this amendment, and what I would like to do is deal with the actively involved and the 6 month period or whatever it becomes, and especially at least at the minimum ensure that the person involved in the game management unit as a in a seasonal or a long-term employment is not allowed to work in the guiding industry in that unit for a certain period of time after they leave state employment. And I would reconsider your comments, Mr. Bruce, regards how that affects that seasonal employee if there's other things. So we will leave the unless there's other discussion on the matter of the time element for people leaving state employment to work in a specific guidance unit or game management unit where they have access to certain inside information which would benefit them in their other efforts to guide people to that game and that game management unit. And the ones that are things like first steps in the thinking.
No, Mr. Chairman, no problem.
Okay. So that conceptual amendment, I would have staff note that we would deal with that and hopefully bring that conceptual amendment back first thing tomorrow when we deal with the bill. Now, back to your concern, Mr. Bruce, if you would please refresh our memory.
The department's concern is that for a seasonal employee, during the period of time that they are not working for the department, restricting their ability to be engaged in a guiding occupation. And, I give you an example of a lease conflict first, and that is that, say, a person who works in the department has some kind of fisheries technician in the commercial fishing or some other area. And they were laid off, and one of the opportunities they have for work in their area is guiding and hunting. Then they would be prohibited from doing that. And it just seems, there's really no, on the one hand they're working in fish, the other hand they're working in game in the private business. And it just doesn't seem like there's that much inside information, so to speak, that's transferred from one to the other. And the person is no longer working for it, is not in any kind of official position during a period of time that they would be able to do this, so they can't use their office. That would be prohibited anyhow, but I mean, even if they were tempted to suddenly try to use it, they're not an employee at that point. So. And that's the thing we're trying to address. We're trying to provide some flexibility for some of our seasonal employees to work in a related but non-conflicting field during the period of time when they're not working from the department that they can do.
Are there any questions from the group? No, I'd like to have one of the
questions.
Good. All right. Well,
I'm just trying to understand what Mr. Bruce is trying to do here. you're saying it's too restrictive to prohibit an individual who is working in the fishery space to then turn around and be a big game guide or vice versa.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I use that as probably the, you know, that's the example where there's the least conflict and where I believe that that's probably the most, one of the more common situations where we have a lot of seasonals in the fisheries and, you know, they are, you know, frequently outdoors-minded people, and so, you know, they would look at some kind of employment opportunity in the outdoors field during the same time that they were not working for the department. And if you don't allow them to be involved in guiding, this is one of the major areas that they, you know, they could look to for employment to augment the seasonal pay they have from the department.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite grasping the concept there. That it seems that if a person is in, whether you're in game or fishery, you're still involved in the whole nature of fish or game. I don't think that person exclusively knows fish or exclusively knows game. I think that they feel that transition there. And I guess I would not be one that would be supportive of saying that with exception. I just don't hear the justification for that.
Representative
Biden? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to keep a simple mind here in addressing the game guidance, guide out city license, and talking fishery. I just can't see the connection there.
Well, let me see if I can. It's my understanding, Representative Ivan, that if a person's working on a fish weir here and 400 yards away here, when he's not a state employee, he gets into the game guiding business. And I mean, that's the situation you're talking about, right? Possibility.
Yeah, that's an example. Yeah.
So what we're saying is, this guy here working for the state, knowing the countryside, the game management unit, where the game is, the habitat, he's gaining certain amount of information from the state employment that would benefit his efforts here. And we're trying to say, well, wait a minute, is this fair? Because we're saying that law enforcement officers can no longer now, with this bill, they will no longer be able to do that second job. This guy doesn't have, well, he only has a part-time job, but we still say, Mr. Bruce is saying, well, we should not deny him this opportunity to be active in this game management unit, despite the fact that he may be only 400 or 500 yards away or a mile, whatever it is. And what we're trying to do is get some equity here so that we level the playing field and we're not only going to say that law enforcement officers are the only ones who can not take advantage of their inside information. But the concern here is that this person has inside information as well. But Mr. Bruce says, well, if he's working on the fish weir, he probably doesn't have that kind of inside information. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying it's quite a bit different than what you would have if you were actually in the game, managing the game population. But I guess, you know,
tough situation, huh? Thank you, Mr. Bruce. I would like to hear from Mr. Aaron, the staff person to crime conduct. Mr. Aaron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob here again. The Senator appreciates the efforts of the House Resources Committee, but we did talk about this briefly on the Senate side. And to go back to what the Senator says, is that this is a huge step. And what the problem has been troopers and brown shirts allegedly have been able to utilize their enforcement activities to aid in the guiding industry. So the senator's intent is to take that first step and do that. As far as we've heard, you know, the senator understands where the chairman's coming from, but we'd like to take that first step. And if there is a problem with other situations, then we've taken the first step, and the second step will be an easier step. But this first step is very difficult anyway.
As regards the equity issue, Mr. Herring, what would be the senator's feeling as far as, we obviously have people who are potentially enforcement officers, and the law would not apply to them, or would it? What happens if a person becomes deputized while they are no longer their seasonal? No, that doesn't fit the situation. Okay, so we have any other comments?
No, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Bishop, would you care to offer your perspective on this? I know that as a former person type that we're talking about here, maybe you have some useful comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Bishop. I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Bishop. I am speaking on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council. The council had not taken a position on this bill up to the present time. They agreed to monitor and see what direction it went and see what we should do about it. I think, however, that the discussion that's taken place here today has placed it clearly in perspective with regard to the policy that we've had on the books for 3 years. And I'll read you that policy. It's policy number 189. Ethical wildlife harvest by state employees. The Alaska Outdoor Council opposes any state statute, regulation, or policy that discourages or prohibits state employees from legally harvesting fish and game. The council opposes any law or policy that would restrict an employee's ability to legally trap and sell fur, act as a big game or sport fish guide, or participate in commercial fishing when these activities are conducted in accordance with state ethics laws. And the point of that policy was that when the state ethics law passed, like laws sometimes are, it was not clear exactly how it should relate to the rights and privileges of state employees during the times that they were not actually employed by the state. And there were some policies floating around that seemed to indicate that, in fact, it would not, Department of Fish and Game people and possibly public safety and the wildlife protection would be unable to do certain things that judging by the state ethics law, perhaps were okay. And so the Outdoor Council looked at it and said, well, as best we can figure out, if people who are state employees, and in particular maybe Fish and Game or Fish and Wildlife Protection employees, adhere to the laws relating to legally taking game, and if they adhere to the state ethics law, which in its essence says that a state employee may not use his or her position for profit, either their own or someone else's, that those employees should be able to engage in any of these lawful activities without a conflict of interest. The reason that we were reluctant to get into this issue with regard to this bill was it was clear that there was a public perception that there was a real problem with enforcement in relation to the guiding thing. And that is certainly a potential problem. But with respect to my perspective on it, I'll have to say that in the course of over 20 years, nearly 25 years in the wildlife profession and in association with fish and wildlife protection officers and biologists from the various divisions of the Department of Fish and Game, the incidences of actual conflicts were very, very rare. Very rare. The most common that I have heard of related to commercial fishing. And frankly, I did not know of any personally, but I was informed by people that, yes, that can happen. And so there were personnel rules adopted under the state ethics law that relate to that and to some other commercial type activities. And in fact, I'm not sure, I don't remember about the rules in place right now in the Department of Fish and Game. There may be a prohibition on guiding under the state ethics law. And that, I guess, brings me to another point. I have the feeling that number one, this proposed law probably overlaps significantly with the state ethics law. I don't know. Number two, I think that it is, I think the concern that's raised reflects what is commonly a real overreaction to this perceived problem. And I guess with regard to your particularly expressed concern that people who work for Fish and Game or Fishing Wildlife Protection will gain an undue advantage, that's another thing that I've seen little evidence of in the course of 25 years of work. I know biologists, for example, that hire guides when they want to go hunting because they feel they need the help. So, you know, there's nothing implicit in there that experience is going to give them that advantage. And I think it's a pretty far stretch to presume that that's going to be the case, especially in these significant numbers. And finally, the last comment I'd like to make is I'm really seriously concerned with a law like this on reflection and on listening to the discussion that it may breach the appropriate degree of restriction on state employees' legal activities when they're not on duty or not employed by the state. And the idea in particular of having a waiting period, I guess, after your employed perhaps as a seasonal or even as a permanent, until you can undertake something else, I believe personally that it's unfair. And I really have serious concerns that it may be unconstitutional as well.
Thank you. So you really think that we should become lobbyists as soon as we get out of office?
I think, Mr. Chairman, in answer to that, I don't know if the state ethics law applies to legislators, it applies to employees of the administration. I think there's a similar law that applies to legislators, and I think that under terms of that law, we wouldn't be able to do that. I'm not sure. Maybe after you
know, the ethical issue means that you bring up the idea of self-regulation that is going to cover us here in the situation. When did you get your statement
from that? Mr. Chairman, let me indicate that self-regulation is not. There has to be some rules. And pointed, there is the form and the framework for rules under state ethics law, and I know that there are policies implemented. In fact, they legally have to be implemented by departments in accordance with that law. So there is a framework and regulations in place and policies. And I've left state employment in 1989.
Well, let me just recapture. You're saying that on second thought, you feel that this law in itself, 375 is probably not needed to
test. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The basic issue of conflict of interest that may result in profit to an individual, be they the employee or the guy in the example that I think is the most popular, is prohibited under the state ethics law. If the state employee misused his position to do that. Now, as I say, the reason we were reluctant to get into this earlier was that it seemed as though it was directed at some of the different issues.
Any comments or questions from the Bishop? Thank you. Well, we still have before us the same balloon here. Vice Chairman Mitchin.
Chairman, did I hear you wrong to say that for that portion of the amendment that you were going to offer was going to come back tomorrow?
Yes, but I'm beginning to wonder if we should
go forward with the conceptual amendment that would allow for no employment by either the seasonal or the law enforcement officer for, say, 3 months after they leave state employment, and maybe that would solve the problem in both ways. That's anything with that?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, it's also to address the,
I'm sorry, I cut off the vice chairman there.
I was just like saying, Mr. Chairman, continuing that, again, I can see prohibiting a person from guiding up to a certain period, if it's 6 months, especially if they're going to be working in the field for a certain period of time. There's only so much more time that they've got in that field in that year. So to prohibit them 6 months down the line from when they began, I don't think is detrimental, or I don't mean detrimental, but that would put anyone out that much. I don't agree, however, again, with this second amendment, which Mr. Bruce was offering. I don't agree with that concept at all, but I would be in favor of adding in here the conceptual amendment, or an amendment, if that is prepared now before us somewhere, to insert it that it would prohibit a person from guiding within a certain period of time, whether that's 3 months or 6 months, and I don't think 6 months is too long. They're working it. We're not saying that they cannot guide in another area, or they cannot guide either big game guide or fishing guide in another area than which they work from. And I don't think that's unreasonable.
Additional comments? Representative Ivan?
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad that the Senator introduced this legislation. I know it's been a problem in my area, and I would not like to see the bill held up. I'm interested in this one moving forward. It's got a basic intent, and it's to address the law enforcement officers out there who are privy to information or have the data. Now, my question, I believe, would be to the Fish and Game Department, if currently the regulations would address the concern that you have about the seasonal employee that may be privy to the same information from commercial fishers or being in the same area with the Fish and Game. What personal regulations do we have that would address that? If not, then maybe we can work at a conceptual amendment.
Mr. Bruce?
I would agree with you.
Could you clarify here for Representative Ivan and the committee, please?
I believe what you're referring to would be like the Administrative Ethics Act and the personnel policies of the Department of Fish and Game. And our policies and the Administrative Ethics Act prohibit a state employee, or and specifically an employee of the Department of Fish and Game, for using his or her official position for their own personal financial betterment. Those policies already exist, and they are similar to what you're trying to address here in this legislation.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Includes the seasonal or part-time employees, right?
Yes, the seasonal and part-time employees would also be subject to that while they are employed by the Department of Fish and Game.
So, what would the effect on a seasonal employee who have, if he were not allowed to be involved with the game management area or unit for 3 months after he left state employment, what would be the impact generally on those individuals? Because most of those individuals probably, first of all, we don't know how many people we're talking about. So who are we protecting here? Whose livelihood are we protecting? At the same time, we're not allowing
law enforcement officers to be involved in any way, at any time, with this industry. So, and yet, the individual who is a seasonal employee has the potential of becoming a law enforcement officer through deputization, right?
Correct.
So,
Well, if I could just,
go ahead.
You know, kind of offer a couple of comments. I listened to some of the discussion on this piece of legislation in the Senate, and it seemed to me that there was perhaps a bit of a different emphasis there. I mean, there it seemed the emphasis was more on prohibiting people who had law enforcement authority from using that law enforcement authority to intimidate or gain advantage in the field over the citizens. And that's one issue and certainly should be prohibited. But now there's another issue, which is whether or not being employed by the Department of Fish and Game and being deputized as a peace officer who enforced Title 16 gives you privy to some kind of inside knowledge that the general public wouldn't have or that other folks wouldn't have. And I just wanted to note that there do seem to be two different ideas running here. And I guess the department's concerns go toward the second of those ideas. And particularly, you know, we are concerned about being overly restrictive on an individual's rights to pursue things in their private life. It has been alluded that there have been problems with public safety officers that have led to this legislation, and I haven't heard of any similar problems on the second of those two issues. So, but maybe it is also a problem, and I guess it is in some people's minds anyhow. But yeah, it doesn't seem to have the same kind of heightened concern that the first does, so.
Well, okay, Mr. Bruce, without further comments, then we'll just hold this bill for conceptual amendments to be written out for tomorrow's meeting, and hopefully we can send this bill along. Next, I'd like to go on to House Bill 135. We've heard this bill, and I do have an amendment. This bill is the attorney substitute for House Bill 135 Resources. We offered this compact bill in the hope that we could regionalize more authority for the western states and those states touching on the Pacific Ocean to have a legal form by which they could not only coordinate but also create a more efficient operation of the transport of hazardous materials. I think that you each have been handed an amendment, and the amendment simply deals with regulatory review, and we do not have a quorum, so we cannot adopt anything. Representative Lincoln.
Mr. Chairman, then this amendment goes on page 12, right?
Right.
The last. Could you explain why the amendment had to be placed in here?
Yes, I have all the
staff. And since we have a quorum.
Right. Leila, did you get Jeff today? I'm just going to address it.
Chairman.
Representative Raymond, or are you?
Yes. waiting for
numbers.
Right.
While we are, maybe you can just refresh my memory on this. How many other states have adopted a similar compact?
State of Oregon.
State of Oregon has, and has California and Hawaii have both declined to, or have they not acted on it?
They're working on it. The effort here is probably one, if this ocean compact would become a reality, I would think that it would take not less than 2 to 5, maybe even 7 years from this point. And we did get a letter from the department with some of their concerns. It's dated April the 22nd, and it's to myself from Ms. Adair. Jay, I'd like to have staff come and address the purpose of the amendment, and if you would please indicate where we want to insert this into it.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jay Nelson. I'm staff to Representative Cliff Davidson. There was a concern expressed about the interstate compact that there were provisions, administrative procedures provisions for the interstate compact will not be as rigorous or similar to what they were for Alaska. And just so that it was clear that our administrative procedures could be, would be adhered to, this provision would make that clear. It certainly would be possible in any case for us to follow our own administrative procedures, but this makes it clear that we would be doing so.
And where do we want to place this?
Well, it'd be, I'm not sure which section, but got the citation, which the numerical citation which would follow.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Additional questions or comments, concerns by the committee? No concerns. Representative Lincoln.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to find the letter that you were speaking of from DEC.
Yeah.
Should
be.
No.
Ms. Adair, would you like to address the letter?
Sure.
Yeah.
I have two extra copies.
Yes, we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Janice Adair, and I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. The last time we heard this bill, you had requested that we put in writing what some of our concerns or questions might be about the compact and the legislation before the committee today. And we have attempted to do that with as much clarity as possible. If you'd like, I'll just go down the list.
If you would, please.
First, there is a concern that with the federal government and the West Coast states having all recently adopted statutory authority for spill response, that to now start another process rolling, we may somehow undermine the process that's currently ongoing before we have the opportunity to evaluate how effective those rules might be that are adopted under the new statutory authorities in the West Coast states and under Congress. The laws that have been passed by Congress and by the West Coast states, as we've seen just even here in Alaska, provide fairly detailed guidance to the departments on what standards to follow, what the regulations should look like, how to develop the contingency planning requirements. House Bill 135 is fairly broad, and so we're not really sure how any regulations might look. Are we really going to get what we want to get out of it with the broad authority that's there? The compact would be authorized to regulate contingency planning requirements for tankers. Some proponents of this have argued that would bring consistency. Others have said, no, this will be done on a regional basis. And we see a conflict there. They're either consistent or they're regional, but they're not necessarily the same.
Excuse me, Ms. Adair, in the interest of time, because we are running rather late, we'll just go
go ahead and
okay.
If you would just kind of summarize okay. the more crucial areas where the department has concern.
Okay. The concern that our existing regulations may be weakened, the regulations adopted under 567. Concern that the compact has authority over our navigable waters, which includes all of our riverways. There is a concern that the authorities, that the compact's authority to establish sanctions and penalties for natural resource damages may limit or somehow affect the state's authority to do the same thing.
Ms. Adair, excuse me, on the navigable rivers, it's my understanding that the compact area was limited to the coastal areas. So I think your letter may be in error here.
We'll look into that. The last that we saw, it still said navigable waters of the state, but we'll look again to see if certain possibly miss something. The department would like to see something reviewed that would have the compact be limited to regulating oil and hazardous material transport in the exclusive economic zone, which would start at the 3-mile limit and extend outward. We feel that that might be a better way to get some consistency, some more, perhaps even more stringent regulation on the books for those areas.
Of course, that was the entire intent, you know, to ensure that the Pacific Coast states would in fact increase their ability to deal with the federal government in the EEZ. Again, I'm not clear on what some of your concerns here are, but please continue.
Well, the compact, even if it says up to the coast, is still within the 3-mile boundary. We'd like to have our regulations and our processes stay in place and intact for that, and look outside that area for something different. So in the interest of time, I will stop there. The letter, I think, the letter, as I said, summarizes what some of the issues are more clearly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Adair. Are there questions for Ms. Adair? I appreciate your time, Janice. I know you're probably overworked.
Makes two of us, right?
Thank you. Penny, I have a question regards the 3-mile limit. You've done a lot of work on this bill. Could you address that, please, the concerns that the state regulations would be affected by, the compact, and how we would be able to deal with that as a state to ensure that we do not have lesser standards?
Hey, my name is Jimmy Fay. I'm staff to Senator Sam Cotton, who's the prime sponsor of SB 102, similar legislation in the Senate. There's a couple things that would help to clarify. Is if you look in Article 2, I think in your bill, it's page 5, the compact zone is defined as the portion of the oceans bordering the parties within the 200-mile exclusive economic zone. Therefore, what that means by definition is that it couldn't include state navigable waters, because we're looking at the area from the state's 3-mile limit and farther. There are some questions though. This definition kind of gives the state its cake and eat it too, because we will maintain our state waters at the same time gaining the federal EEZ. So I, I think it's fairly clear based on these definitions that this won't impact, say, like travel on or transportation on the Yukon River. It's marine, it's intent.
Are there any other questions by members of the committee? Thank you very much.
Chair would entertain a motion to adopt the amendment provided the committee. Vice Chairman Lincoln.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to adopt amendment number one, which is the regulatory review section 46.47040, which would be inserted on page 12 within the line 4, I guess, beginning line 4.
Is there objection? I'm sorry, but I don't know if we adopted the committee substitute last time. Well, for purposes to ensure that we do, could we have a motion, please, to adopt the committee substitute? Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, I move for the adoption of CSHB 135 resources with the amendment number one.
Is there objection? Without objection, and we have before the committee substitute for House Bill 135 resources. What is the pleasure of the committee? Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move no individual recommendation.
Did you ask for unanimous consent? If yes, then there is objection. Would you please call the roll, Mr.
Chairman.
Representative Lincoln.
Before we call the roll, that is also including the fiscal note that we have here.
And then move along with the bill.
That would move along with the bill, but the fiscal note is I think it's somewhat misleading in that, first of all, I don't think that this compact would be ready by 1994 and probably not by 1995.
Right.
So, yes, it would include the fiscal note, but I don't think that we would end up with that kind of fiscal note. Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I state an objection to moving at this time. I just wanted to clarify point, and I know you'd like to go to vote. I have some concerns about this. I know the department has expressed some. Before we move legislation like this, I'd like to address some of these concerns, at least to my satisfaction. I don't think we've done it yet, and that's why I stated my objection. I'd like to hold on to this a little bit longer if it would be possible.
Well, note that.
I'll be voting not yet. Interested.
Thank you. Please call the roll, Leila.
Representative Moyer?
Yes.
Representative Finkelstein?
Yes.
Representative Carney?
Yes.
Representative
Lehman?
No.
Representative Eisen?
Yes.
Vice Chair Lincoln?
Yes.
Chairman Davidson?
Yes. So, with that, House Bill, Committee Substitute House Bill 135, of the House Resources Committee with individual representation. Next, I'd like to go to House Senate Bill 391. This is the first hearing that we'll have here for Senate Bill 391, and Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Molly McCammon, and I'm staff assistant to Senator Lyman Hoffman, who's the prime sponsor of SB 391. This bill was introduced because of the growing problem in rural areas due to the increase of undetected spills of hazardous materials, especially fuel oil, which have contaminated public water supplies. In the past 2 years, fuel spills have contaminated the supplies of the communities of Tuxet Bay, Minto, and Marshall. In each case, the Department of Environmental Conservation reacted with a spill response team to identify the source of the pollution and initiate the cleanup. The cleanup was paid for with funds from the state's oil spill cleanup fund, which is referred to as the 470 fund. However, although DEC could clean up the contamination, there has been no legal mechanism to allow DEC to use the 470 fund to replace the contaminated water source. Instead, communities have had to go through the normal capital appropriation process in order to provide funding for new water sources in these communities. This process can take months and even years with a substantial added cost.
During that time, residents have had to pack water, usually from unreliable and marginal sources. This has created an especially difficult situation for those communities and their schools and other facilities. SB 391 would allow the 470 fund to be tapped for the expense of replacing the contaminated water system with a new one. This could be done during the cleanup process using the same crew and equipment, which would substantially reduce the state's costs. We estimate that those savings would be somewhere between $75,000 and $150,000 for each system. The 470 fund was created to help people who have suffered from a hazardous material spill. We believe SB 391 would help the fund live up to its purpose. This legislation is strongly supported by the administration. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Are there questions by members of the committee? Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the statement you just read, Molly, it says that absent this bill, communities have to go through the normal capital appropriations process. I wonder if you could explain what that is exactly, and if we did have the bill passed, would they still go through that process? It takes longer, I assume, and pay any money back, or is it just a one straight shot appropriation?
The way the bill is drafted right now, the way the process works now is that the crew is in there cleaning up the water system. They've identified what's the polluted aquifer. They're cleaning it up, but there is no way that they can use the 470 fund to drill a new well, which is essentially all that needs to be done, even though they have all the equipment in there. So what happens is that either people have to pack water, they have to do some kind of marginal deal. The normal capital appropriation process is either going through a legislative discretionary fund through that process, or getting on the Village Safe Water list, which, you know, depending on where things are and how much money is appropriated, usually would take 1 to 2 years. So we're looking at that. The way this is currently drafted, DEC and the Department of Law would go to the responsible party to recover cleanup costs. And that would also, the way it's currently drafted, would be the same for restoration of the drinking water supply. Although Representative Lincoln does have an amendment regarding that issue.
Well, at least for the moment, that satisfies Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions or comments, Vice Chairman Lincoln?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question to ask, but perhaps it would be appropriate at this time to introduce the amendment which you all have in your packet, and I would offer that as amendment number one. You will see where it is placed on page one after line nine in section one. Then it would insert a new section, and then it would renumber the bill accordingly. But this amendment provides that the state may not seek reimbursement or recovery of the containment and cleanup costs if the responsible party is the municipality or a local government. It would limit the containment and cleanup costs incurred in the act of restoring safe drinking water to a village. The section three defines the containment cleanup, which includes the restoration of the unsafe public drinking water supplies or the provisions of the safe alternative drinking water supplies. The amendment is offered because in rural Alaska, local governments do not have the funds to undertake containment and cleanup activities, much less restoring their drinking water supplies. So, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any questions, I offer this as amendment number one.
Are there questions regarding amendment number one? Representative Lima.
Mr. Chairman, I don't object to the intent of what Representative Lincoln is trying to accomplish, but I object to the mechanism, because what I want the 470 fund to be available for are some of these types of activities where we do recover from responsible parties, so we can have the fund there. And the more we open it up to things like this, there's the less chance the fund is going to build up and be available. The problem with this approach, and I concur that these villages probably don't have the resources to respond and repay, but instead of taking that money from the 470 fund, a better source would be from some other fund, the general fund perhaps, if the community does not have the resources, instead of continuing to tap from a 470 fund set up for a different purpose. And this is, to me, it's just continual erosion of the intent of the 470 fund and its integrity. And for that reason, I don't think we're going to plan to move this today anyway, maybe have an amendment to the amendment we can work on where actually those funds are going to be coming from.
Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wished I had brought with me, but we had this amendment. I had a similar companion bill to Senator Hoffman's, and it has passed through the HES committee. In the statistics I had, I believe there were three, I want to say two, but and I might have this reversed. Either it was two villages in 3 years or three villages in 2 years that had to utilize the 470 funds. That this does not occur that frequently in the villages, but when it does occur, that they need to have an immediate response. Is a gentleman here from Marshall now in the audience that certainly can attest that what Marshall had to go through to get the safe drinking water, and had it not been for the 470 funds, we wouldn't have been able to even respond, I can't say as quickly as we did. Marshall ended up having to, their benzene level in the water was 100 times higher than acceptable level, and they not only couldn't drink it, but they couldn't bathe in it because it was so dangerous. And the state responded, and it was quite a lengthy time for the response there. But this does not occur very often, but we have in the villages, and I certainly can understand what Representative Lehman is saying on where to get the money from, but we need to have an immediate response for these situations that occur just very, very infrequently out there, and that is the only source at this time.
Representative Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Response. I agree with the part of the response of my colleague, and that is this bill, as written, provides that mechanism for a community like Marshall to come up with a quick source and also to come up with a new water source. But what the amendment does, and that's really what I was speaking to, is that would prevent the commissioner from seeking recovery. I think probably in the case of Marshall and perhaps the other villages you're talking about, for the commission to seek recovery, probably wouldn't get anything. Probably likely aren't the ready assets available to recover, or the insurance there. And so, but I still think that the 470 fund is not the correct source to be coming from. There may be a public responsibility, or a corporate responsibility as a state, but I don't agree that the 470 fund is that corporate responsibility. I think it's there for the emergency, and then we should be looking at restoring that fund, perhaps from some other funds that we have available as part of our compassionate corporate responsibility as a citizen of the state of Alaska. And that's my suggestion. I think the mechanism to have a ready source is a good one, but I don't agree with this particular provision.
And Representative Lehman, which other funds? From which other funds?
Yeah, well, I know that that's the big problem, because we have declining funds, and that's why I think so many people are looking to the 470 funds as available funds. But we still have to recognize that the original purpose that they were there for, we need to protect them. And I differ with some of the people in the department on this, and I will continue to do so, because I think if we continue to basically raid that fund, it's not going to be there for the purposes for which we intend. That's how I feel. I recognize there are others who think otherwise, and I just believe I need to express that and do all I can to protect it.
Thank you. Mr. Cameron, did you have any further remarks or comments?
No, I didn't.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Representative Moyer?
Well, where are we at, Mr. Chairman? Have we adopt this amendment? Or
the amendment.
We're simply becoming familiar with the amendment at this point. I would hope that we would wait before we adopt the committee substitute, which would include the amendments. In fact, that's what we could do.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, speak to that amendment. Becoming familiar with it, I am somewhat sympathetic to it, but at the same time, if I understand it correctly, what we're basically saying is the village, because it probably has no ability to pay, if it caused an unsafe drinking water situation to occur, it's not responsible for restitution. And I ask, what is the compelling public policy reason to allow that? Basically, you're taking away any incentive not to have a release if you're never going to be responsible for it.
One moment.
Need I repeat myself?
You need not repeat yourself. I understood the question and the response that I have, and certainly Molly can respond to it too, but the response is, I don't think that there's any community out there who would knowingly go out and create a spill just because that they did not have to pay it back. So again, I reiterate that there have been either three villages, 2 years, or 2 years, three villages in 2 years, something one way or the other. And I think that every community is very aware of the need for safe disposal of waste. And because the response in rural Alaska is extremely slow for many reasons, and it is their community's health that they're most concerned about. So I don't think that anybody either knowingly or ignorantly turns their face when it comes to any kind of a chemical disposal. I guess I am chairing this meeting right now, so please continue.
No, I would not suggest in any way that a village would knowingly cause such thing to happen because they know they wouldn't be held responsible for restitution. Certainly not. There are always ways that these things manage to happen through whatever, carelessness or some freak accident. And what I might suggest is, instead of a blanket, the department cannot do this, and maybe as a public policy matter, it would be better to say that they may do it, and in deciding that whether or not they do it, they take into account these extenuating circumstances that may point to the fact of total innocent mistake or inability to pay, whatever it may be. But I guess I'm not yet convinced that a blanket off the hook is good public policy here.
With
all due respect, Madam Chair, and Maker of Amendments.
Representative Ivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions, and I'd like to share some discussion and dialogue with Representative Moyer there. Hopefully I can provide some light to some of the situation in rural Alaska. Question one, regarding this fiscal note published March 6th, it says that any cost associated with this legislation would be recovered from the party responsible for the contamination. Does your amendment then do away with this fiscal note as it was written?
No, it does not.
Okay. As far as I know, one community is listed that I you represent the Neskipsic Bay, same situation as Marshall. The reaction time out there is certainly slow, and when human life and human lives are at stake in emergency situation, I'd ask the communities to rob a bank if necessary to correct that problem at this point in time. And I wish we could. Are there disaster funds available to address these types of problems that occurred?
There could be. Ms. McKenna?
There could be. Now, it will take legislation to establish funds like that, or does the governor have that authority to declare disaster and take care of these human life situations?
Do you wish to respond to that question?
Well, there are, at times, the state looks at what a definition of a disaster is pretty narrowly, and the whole point of this bill and the intent of it is that you have a fund that's being accessed already for the cleanup. That's not in contention. I think everyone agrees that the 470 fund was designed. I mean, that's the purpose of it, is for cleanup. And it's just that to put in, I don't know if it would meet the terms of a disaster, because it would probably depend on a case-by-case situation. But what you're dealing with is a community that's having a potentially unsafe drinking water system with potential disease problems, sickness problems, that could last for as long as 2 to 3 years. And what we're looking at trying to save is actually save the state money, because you have the work crew already there. They're being paid for by the 470 fund. It doesn't make sense to say, okay, send all this equipment home, send this crew home, and then we'll, you know, bring you back 2 years from now to drill a new well. It just doesn't make sense. And I think the reason behind Representative Lincoln's amendment is that for the small communities, they have no asset. And so what you're going to end up doing is DEC is either going to be discretionary now, which in some cases they already are, Department of Law, or they're going to spend a lot of time on legal fees. It's going to require the community to spend time in legal fees to come to some kind of a settlement for, I mean, what are we talking about? To put in a well, it's not that much money. It just makes it clarifies it makes it simpler. It's state money anyway. It's all state money. And it just seems to make it much clearer and cleaner.
Representative Ivan, were you
through? A couple more comments. But reality of life, there are some small communities that just don't have the resources, and emergencies do occur. And, again and again, we've, and I'll certainly request for funding wherever it'll come from, maybe the general fund to address this, and hopefully establish some emergency funding to address that as soon as it happens, and not wait a month or a couple months after the fact to address it. But we certainly, I'd like to see the state there to provide, or even provide funds to clean up necessary drinking water sites for communities. And I'd like to, I respect and commend the sponsor for introducing this legislation, wherever the funding will come from to address these emergency situations. We just don't have funds in some of those small communities.
I guess just one other point I could make is that I mean, if there is, if you agree with the concept of using the 470 fund to go ahead and replace the water system, if that is an okay concept, then for use of the 470 fund for that, then if the concern is paying back the fund, the problem is that once you've replaced the water system, you no longer have an emergency. I mean, you fixed the problem. So then making replacement or restitution to the fund is not really, it's not an emergency situation. So I think it would be difficult to access other funds, emergency funds for that. It would also not come up as high on the Village Safe Water list because it's no longer an emergency. The problem's been taken care of. So, I mean, I think it would be difficult to use other funds to do that. Representative Lehman.
Chairman, I think that we should. Molly, I think that's exactly my statement, that we shouldn't be continuing to take from that fund. I have some other comments about responsibility of our, those parties are responsible here, but we have representatives from the department that I think may want to comment, or whether she does or not, I'd like to hear a comment from the department on their thoughts on this particular amendment, and if Mrs. Barrett would like to share with us, I'm sure you should.
Absolutely. Could state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is Janice Adair. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. The department does support Senate Bill 391, but we do not support the amendment that's been offered today. We actually do have situations in communities, not in your district, not in Representative Ivan's district, but in another rural district, where we have literally been on one side of the building cleaning up contamination, and an operator has been on the other side of that very same building spilling fuel out of a garden hose trying to get it out of one tank into another. We've got it on film. It was amazing. It happens. And it's not to say that someone wouldn't purposely do that, but it's important to know that it does happen. And one of the reasons why we supported the bill as it was written and not without the amendment is because we do want to encourage safe fuel handling practices. The department does have some discretion through the Department of Law as to whether or not to seek recovery. To further clarify that, as Representative Moyer suggested, may very well be a good idea. That's our position on this one.
Other further questions? Representative Lehman?
Dennis, I don't remember if it was 2 or 3 years ago, but when the House Bill 220 was being discussed, the version that passed the House and went to the Senate, I think you were on Senate staff then, contained a provision for a nominal fuel tax that would go into a fund that would be available for underground storage tank repairs and leaks and things like that. And I know this is, you know, it's a concept that's not really here, but if we have communities that are basically trying to opt out of responsibility for recovery, would that be something, or maybe it's something to think about, that the department might support as a potential fund for these types of things? And if indeed there are limited numbers, like just 2 or 3 communities either a year or in a few years, it's possible that funds raised that way may be available. And I'm just looking at a way, as Richard Moyer talked about, to help people be responsible for their actions. And yet, I agree with the concept of the bill, which is if somebody has an emergency, then I think we have a responsibility to reach in and help that emergency.
Miss Adair.
Representative.